Welcome to Tech on Reg, the podcast that explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and high regulated industry. We're talking fintech, regtech, sex tech, and more with thought leaders and entrepreneurs from around the world to share insights, trade viewpoints, and get us all thinking about responsible innovation. And here is your host, Dara Tikowski.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Tech on Reg, the podcast that discusses all of the interesting intersections between the law, technology, and highly regulated industry. Today's episode, we are discussing open banking, the opportunities, the state of open banking here in the US, and very specifically, sort of the very complicated, politicized, and tense regulatory environment that industry participants have to deal with here in the United States. Our guest today is Brian Costello, Vice President of Data Strategy and Strategic Solutions at Envestnet Yodlee. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be chatting with you. This is a subject I have a lot of energy around.
Well, energy is good. Listeners like energy. Before we really launch into the nerdy details of open banking and regulation of open banking, I think it's important. We've got a really diverse listener crowd here on Tech on Reg. So I want to make sure that we set the stage properly. So when you and I sit and talk about open banking, in your words, why don't you let our listeners know what we mean when we say that?
Yeah, happy to. We're going to get nerdy pretty quick, though.
So I know.
Open banking with a small O, small B, essentially means that a consumer or a small business has the right and the ability to access the financial data, or all of their data, really, that their financial institutions have about them. They should access it, be able to permission access to it, use that data for any legal purpose, and the institution holding that data should have some requirements on safeguarding the data. So open banking is really one implementation of an open data principle, which started with government, which says, as citizens, we should be able to know and access all the data that our governmental institutions have about us, use it, correct it, and then the institution has to protect it. And so open banking is applying that principle to financial services.
So here in the U.S., right, there's no legal requirement essentially stipulating that a financial institution has to make a customer's financial data available to a third party, even if that consumer provides affirmative consent, right?
That's correct. In fact, there's actually some regulatory friction around doing that, and I'm happy to jump into that right now, sort of maybe to set the stage for.
Friction is a great way. Let's start with friction.
Let's go. Right. Well, you know, friction makes heat, and the strongest steel comes from the hottest fire. So think about the last time you opened a bank account. You had to read some disclosures, or you were presented with some disclosures, and then you had to answer a few questions. First, you had to answer consent to the bank using your data in order to provide you with the services that you had asked for. And you also had to consent to them to be able to use your data for certain legal requirements like anti-money laundering and fraud detection and Bank Secrecy Act, et cetera. Then you were asked a question by the bank: may we share your data with affiliated third parties who would like to offer you goods and services? And you probably said no, but you might have said yes. The next question is, may we share your data with unaffiliated third parties so that they may offer you goods and services? And you very likely said no. So now in the current consumer
because you didn't
data,
because you didn't want to be sold stuff, right?
You didn't want to be sold to. Right.
Exactly.
Right. You made the determination that these unaffiliated third parties really didn't have anything of interest to you. So now you're carrying on with your daily life, and somebody's told you about this fantastic app that helps you manage your money, or you've decided to buy a new car or a new house, and you're engaging with a responsible lender. And rather than bringing in your shoebox of bank statements, they have an online process. So you go through this online process. You entrust, you link your bank accounts, you entrust your credentials, and the aggregator or the service provider goes to your bank and says, we're here on behalf of Joe Bloggs, and here's the credentials. Please give us this data. So the bank is now in a conundrum because here comes an unaffiliated third party.
Right. The bank turns around and says, oh, sorry, yeah, our bad. We can't because our customer said we're not allowed to do that.
But they don't, because they understand what's happening here, and they say, they take the path of good customer service and tolerate, and that's an important word, they tolerate this access, and they provide the data, and they basically say, well, if something really bad happens, we'll either eat the loss or we'll make the customer responsible for it. But it puts us in a bad spot. So this fragmented ecosystem is one of the things that we're trying to address when we talk about open banking. So in the UK, open banking, capital O, capital B, is a regulatory-backed regime to do this, to put in traceability and protection on each of the types of parties in the ecosystem and put a liability framework on there. So if bad things happen, customers are protected and they're made whole by the party that was responsible for the harm. That's what we're attempting to do in the U.S., but there's lots of headwinds on that.
Let's put a pin in that for a second, because we're definitely going to get back to what the EU is doing that the U.S. is not, and kind of like where that tension really stems from. But before we get too far into the weeds, for our listeners who may be sort of less familiar with Yodlee and kind of like your role and Yodlee's role in this ecosystem that you just described, could you just, give us sort of a high-level overview? Tell us about Yodlee's role and why you're so passionate about this.
Happy to. So Yodlee, we're about 20 years old, and we are the global market leader in consumer permissioned aggregation services. So before open banking initiatives, there was a commercial market to allow consumers to access their data at their financial institutions, permission its use by third parties to receive goods and services. And so we've, for 20 years, have provided that plumbing. So if you have used any kind of an application where you've entrusted your online banking credentials to a third party in order for them to access your bank account data to provide you with coaching, or if you're using a registered financial advisor and they're providing good fiduciary advice to you and looking at taking a holistic view of your finances, if you've applied for a loan online or any kind of, other personal finance management, there's a good bet that we're the plumbing behind that. We actually started out as a service provider to banks who wanted you to be able to see all your accounts in one place. The idea being that as a consumer, if I can see all my accounts in one place, I can make better financial decisions. So I can see all my ins, all my outs, all my spending at McDonald's and Burger King across all my credit cards, debit cards, and I've got a nice pie chart, a nice bar chart showing it. What we've learned over the years is that just seeing your spending isn't helpful. It's actually somewhat depressing. If it's the reason I don't get on the scale in the morning. I see the data. I see how it's trending. I don't know what to do about it. I'm going to stop looking at it. This is important.
So back when I think you guys first launched, I was one of those customers who looked at that very sad listing and spreadsheets of all of the ins and outs. So your sentiment is resonating with me.
Very good. So open banking actually addresses one of these concerns, because we're at a really important point right now. So we've got regulatory support in developing around the globe to harmonize the regulations and to put in place very cohesive consumer protections. We've got computing power readily available. We've got algorithms now that can analyze consumers' data and using their own data provide very personalized advice or decisions. And putting all this together means that as individuals, we can receive essentially bespoke financial services, whether it be advice or product recommendations, based on our own data, not just our financial data, not just our financial behaviors across how we save, spend, borrow, plan, and protect, but our stage in life and our life goals. And we can receive this advice and these engagements in ways that are meaningful to us if we're Gen X or millennial, if we like to play games or if we need nudges, right? We can take behavioral economics. And so this is a great time to do all this. And that's what Yodlee does today.
Right. And
we do all of that today.
These are things that consumers have already vocally articulated that they want from their FIs, right?
Absolutely. Most people don't want to just save money for the sake of saving money. They want to achieve life goals, and they need help. At one end, we have very vulnerable consumers who don't who can't weather can't deal with a $400 unexpected expense without going to credit. They don't know how they're going to save for a house. They don't know how they're going to plan for retirement. And we believe that absent bad behavior on Wall Street, the next financial crisis we're going to have is underfunded retirement. And so with our parent company, Envestnet, which is focused on providing tools to registered financial advisors, we are very focused on how do we enable consumers around the globe to prepare for retirement.
All right. So I think we're at a point, right? Like, consumers have said they want it. They want this. They want these capabilities. They need this type of assistance. As you said, we have the computing power. We know what it ought to look like. We have the pipes. The pipes are there. And I think that, you know, you and I would certainly agree, and I think most commentators would also agree that it's really time for the U.S. to get on board and participate in the open banking, capital O, capital B, to use your jargon. But as we mentioned, you know, in the context of open banking in Europe, regulation is driving the market. That's why it's a capital O and that's why it's a capital B. The concern here, small c, is that sort of center-driven regulation is often met with suspicion by U.S. citizens. Regulation from the center has overtones of socialism, and I'm going to try to keep like 2020 presidential election politics aside for a second. But generally, it's a highly, you know, it's divisive word. It's not cultural, and attempts at sort of top-down open banking, I think some would argue, would leave many questions in that regard. So in that respect, and because of just the general regulatory framework of the United States generally for financial services, you know, our state versus federal regulatory regime, which affects all sorts of issues well beyond open banking, how do you believe that sort of adoption is best accomplished in the U.S., given the structure that we have to exist in?
Yeah. How long is the podcast? 3 hours? Okay. we can just scratch the surface.
Thesis. We'll start with the thesis.
So first of all, I respect your opinion. I don't see this as anywhere near socialism. So if we take a general definition of socialism, saying distribution.
To be clear, I don't think open banking is socialism. I think generally people feel that regulation from the center down to drive markets, that conceptually people get antsy about it. So no, I don't think little O, little B open banking is a socialist proposition at all. I actually think it drives bigger markets and better markets, but it's the sort of centrist regulation.
Yeah. So I think, if we look at some of the other regimes that are doing an open banking type regulation. So the UK Open Banking Initiative came out of the Competition Authority on the heels of a study that they did, a very, very detailed study that said it's very difficult for consumers to switch banks, even if they wanted to switch banks. And it's so difficult, and there's so few institutions, that this essentially constitutes a monopoly, and we need ways to make this, to make the market more open for the benefit of consumers, so that we can get actually the market forces of competition. And so coming off the heels of that study and looking at what was happening in Europe with the revised payment service regulation, which was an uplift to the existing payment service regulation designed to level the playing field for consumer protection across all the member countries, they came up with their open banking initiative and standards, which excellent intention. Implementation is a little bit rocky for a number of reasons, and we don't have to go into that here. But it was designed for a positive end. Australia started with their consumer data right, under which open banking is the first implementation, and then we're going to have telecommunication and energy, for again very good intention to allow to ensconce open data principles into the regulations with a affirmative consumer or citizen right for them to access their data. Canada, like, very similar to it's a bit of a mashup of the two of them. They want good they want competition and innovation to flourish with good consumer protection. So if we look at the U.S., if we look at a federal...
Well, I do think, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I do think that there are other overtones and other areas that are being regulated in the U.S. Privacy is a good example of that, that conceptually is getting on board with the notion that the consumers have rights to their data, what is to be done with it, who is to have it, who should have access to it. You know, the CCPA, California Consumer Privacy Act, is a great example of that in terms of sort of like the philosophical notion that like customers get to decide what happens with their data.
Yes, I agree. But the headline of every privacy regulation is protection, and portability is way down at the bottom. And so if we want consumer privacy regulations to help us here, portability has to be on par with protection. Because if it's not, the data's not portable, then allowing access to qualified, authorized, properly permissioned third parties is very, very difficult. And that's one of the headwinds that I mentioned in the preamble.
So I think this is like a perfect segue. Let's talk CFPB for a minute. There's an opportunity there, no, within the CFPB's authority and Dodd-Frank specifically. So here's what we do know is we know that Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act legislates U.S. citizens' access to their financial data. And it has been argued, I think, by several that this is the part of the law and, you know, other documents that have and positions that have come out of the CFPB that, quote unquote, open banking is being encouraged in the context of this central body. But they have not taken the next step. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. So Section 1033 in Dodd-Frank says that a covered person, I'll paraphrase, you know, a bank shall make available to the consumer upon request information in their control or possession concerning their financial products and services that the consumer gets from the bank. So that's a bit more legally way to say what I said up front. Consumers have a right to access the information their institutions have about them, but it's qualified by saying the 1033 says subject to rules prescribed by the Bureau. And so as of yet, the Bureau has not exercised their rulemaking authority to really define this. You're spot on. They're heavily invested in this. And I really applaud the Bureau under the current leadership and the prior leadership under Director Cordray. They're really, really invested in this. Their Project Catalyst has been doing really good work to understand and to frame and to consult and cajole and to inspire industry, but they haven't made a rule yet. And the lack of a rule means that other rules, other laws that are already in place have to take priority.
Right.
And because of that, like Reg E, which makes banks accountable for, you know, among other things, make banks accountable for losses, is what's coloring the innovation and the access to tools and services that depend on the consumer's data.
So do you have any thoughts about why that hasn't come to be yet? I mean, I have probably a few thoughts, but I'm curious to know what you think the why is behind why they have not yet exercised their rulemaking authority that they clearly have.
So it's primarily because
I know it's a tough one.
Very complex.
It's a tough one.
it's a complex issue, and there are very passionate stakeholders on many sides of it. Right. So let's play out a typical conversation that happens in state capitals and on the Hill. And by the way, these conversations happen on Parliament Hill in Canada and Westminster in the UK. So we make a law that says consumers can access their data at the bank, and the bank has to make it available to them in an electronic format, which is essentially what I'm saying. Okay, what electronic format? What is
the total non-standardized one that nobody has because nobody's data looks the same?
Right. Right. So if we're going to prescribe a standard, if the government's going to prescribe a standard, industry is going to throw up their hands and say, "You got to be kidding me, right? Where's the innovation in that? What about the existing market that's going on? You've got the incumbents on the financial institution side who have other factors that they have to consider in terms of return to their shareholders in terms of how do they compete in a market where you've got less unregulated or less regulated competitors. I mean, all of these things come to Washington when the CFPB is thinking about making a rule. And then you've got the other prudentials, right? The other prudentials are saying, well, wait a minute, if you're going to make a rule and we have to put in place an authorization scheme bigger than the one we already have, what a lot of people don't know is there's already the ability for the federal banking regulators to examine large scale technical service providers in the market. In fact, Yodlee is examined by the federal banking agencies under the Bank Services Act, but that's because we provide a lot of services to the banks. The small fries, no. And in fact, the OCC floated an idea to do this, and the state
Everyone
supervisors
freaked out.
Went to court. Right, everybody freaked out.
So the
CFPB is looking to not disrupt an already fragmented market, and using not their rulemaking authority yet, but using their position and their influence to try to get all the stakeholders, if not singing in total unison, at least not not a cacophony. Took me a second there to continue that metaphor. Not a cacophony. and so if you look at their guidelines that they published on principles for consumer permission data or consumer data sharing, I mean, that was a great step. That was a great step. And it was very similar to what a lot of stakeholders worked on with Center for Financial CFSI, which is now the Financial Health Network, which agreeing on principles for enablement and consumer protection. But rulemaking is necessary. We need in this country an affirmative right.
Right. There are some necessary initial. There are some necessary initial steps that need to happen, including, I guess, the CFPB getting the comfort level that, as you say, the stakeholders, industry participants, large and small, are going to be comfortable enough. Right. No one's ever going to be 100% comfortable. That's nonsense. That's not possible, but comfortable enough that they feel as though they can exercise their rulemaking and that SBRIFA won't be a giant disaster and to move things along.
Right. And that lawsuits and stays and injunctions aren't filed immediately upon that. So.
Oh, well, has that ever stopped a federal regulator from issuing a rule before?
Well, we can have a conversation
about political appointees. Yeah, you don't actually have to answer that. I think anyone who can access PACER knows the answer to that question. So is perhaps the answer sort of like an industry consortia model first? Do we just need to get everyone in a big room with you know, endless cocktails and say, guys, we have to figure this out or the government is not going to do it. And all of our customers are going to be really pissed off.
Well, I think that's part of the solution. And indeed, industry has already risen to that need. So the Financial Data Exchange is a relatively new organization, but the members of it have been working in this direction since 2012.
I think of big banks, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells, along with other data aggregators and fintechs, right?
So FDX is an industry consortium made up of financial institutions, the country's biggest data aggregators, what we call permission parties or sort of, you know, quasi-financial institutions, and the third-party providers, the folks that are engaging with consumers and small businesses, to develop a royalty-free interoperability standard for the safe exchange of consumer permission data. And it's modeled on the special interest group model, similar to, say, Bluetooth. So if you think about Bluetooth, you know, if you see the Bluetooth logo, you know, on your car, on a headset, on your music player, it's going to be interoperable with anything else that has Bluetooth on it. We want to come up with a set of data exchange protocols, APIs is the term of art, so that financial institutions of all size can make the data available to the third parties, and those third parties could be aggregators like Yodlee, which then service smaller clients, fintechs or other banks, or in some cases there are some technology companies that might consume directly, like Facebook and Google might want to not use an aggregator and go direct. And we also want to come up with an authorization scheme that doesn't require the end user to entrust their online banking credentials to a third party. We shouldn't be in this situation today. We are because of a few missteps that happened about a decade ago around improving authentication in online banking. I don't want to dwell on that because we've got to deal with what we have today.
Sure.
But if we can, we'll solve those problems. Those challenges, so we have a more reliable exchange of data and consumers don't have to entrust their online banking credentials. That goes a long way to helping policymakers and regulators feel better about putting rules in the system, because these rules are not just for leveling the playing field for competition and innovation and allowing innovation to flourish, but it's for consumer protection. And you can't have wholesome consumer protection unless you've got a liability framework based on very good traceability and prescriptive standards.
Here's a question I have from kind of a practical nature. I hear, and by the way, I'm 150% on board with everything you just said. In preparation for our chat today, I was reading a lot, looking at sort of lots of industry commentary on the state of open banking in the U.S., where the regulations need to go, and then some sort of market observations as well. And a friend of the Provoke family, Ron Shavlin, had written an article for, I think it was Forbes, not too long ago, and made sort of an interesting observation that I'm super curious to get your reaction to. So Ron wrote that many people like to say that data is the new oil. And in his words, is oil, quote, a resource easily and freely shared between those who have it and those who want it? Of course not. So why should we and would we have data be easily and freely shared in this context?
Yeah. So I have a lot of respect for Ron. I don't think and we hear this all the time, that data is the new oil. I think a more apt comparison is that data is the new air, right? As consumers, we generate data about ourselves and about our behaviors on everything that we do, and so being able to use that data for our own purposes, to share that data with the third parties that we've chosen that we've decided are best suited to help us achieve positive outcomes, financial outcomes, health outcomes, lifestyle outcomes, entertainment outcomes, is absolutely essential. I think this is more a human rights issue than it is protecting a supply chain or a sectoral privacy issue. And that's why I, as Brian speaking for Brian, am very much behind the notion of a federal privacy regulation, almost a constitutional right to privacy. Not that I think we need an amendment, but a federal privacy, right? Wouldn't that be interesting? Regulation.
Everyone in Washington is getting along so well right now. It'd be super easy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And then, of course, we go to the states if we get it ratified. But we need to do what some other countries have done, which has said that almost at a human rights level, we have the right to have the data, to control the data about us, to use the data about us, and to hold third parties accountable for adhering to and respecting that, you know, adhering to the requirements of using our data and respecting our rights over the data. And
well,
we try to do that in banking, we try to do it in healthcare, but we need it across the board.
So I think you're about to launch into this, but I'm going to ask this question. And this is one of my favorite questions to ask guests. So pretend it is, we're suspending time, we're suspending reality. You, Brian Costello, have just been named director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Congratulations. You now have the authority to sort of dictate strategy and rulemaking priority under 1033 of Dodd-Frank about open banking. What type of solution do you architect?
Yeah, so I think 1033, I'm sorry, did you say congratulations or condolences? Under 1033.
See, I mean, it's a theoretical congratulations.
I know, I gotcha. So I would put the Bureau on a path to making a rule that not much more narrowly as it's currently defined under 1033, ensconces in the Federal Register the affirmative right for consumers to access and permission access to the data that their financial institutions have about them. And as part of doing that, I would move the appropriate levers to get a review of the existing regulations like Reg E that reasonably interfere with that to get the regulations harmonized so that banks feel less risk in doing this. I would also request that the FFIEC, the Federal Financial Information Examination Council, IT subcommittee, get involved in the work that FDX is doing, that OpenID is, Foundation is doing around these various standards for consumer permission data exchange, to come up with, and probably NIST would have to get involved, to come up with the guidelines for operating these type standards. Not to prescribe something, that's not what these organizations do, but to come up with the guidelines so that we have basically the bumpers in the gutters so that we can play the game, but know that we know where our boundaries are. That's how I would approach it.
Well, it sounds like you have given this a great deal of thought. You'd make an excellent director. And I really appreciate you spending time with me this afternoon getting nerdy about open banking.
It's absolutely my pleasure. If we can solve this problem more fully, we are going to have more financially healthy consumers, which makes for more financially healthy families and communities, and ultimately serves public policy issues like access to housing, access to education, keeping folks off the welfare rolls, optimizing fixed incomes for our veterans and for our seniors. This is absolutely essential, and it's good work that needs to be done. So thank you for the opportunity.
No problem. Thank you so much for being on with us, Brian. Keep strategizing and creating solutions over at Yodlee. Really appreciate your time and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you.
Have a good one.